First, I want to say it's an honor to be speaking here in a session named after Abner. It's really very difficult to even think about him at the moment, but I'll do my best. There's some other people who are no longer with us who are worth looking at also here on the screen. I thought I'd start out with it. We have Wigner, and Schwinger is the main character here, Dirac. So Schwinger's front and center. This is from one of the Mike Kefareda talks in Lindau. Schwinger gave a really nice talk there in the early 80s. I recommend everyone watch. If they go to my homepage, they can find it there. It's really wonderful. So I really also want to thank the previous speaker for all of the mathematics that he presented, because I needed it, and I thought it was too much, and I couldn't do it. And I'm not kidding. I mean, it's the first half of the talk, it will dovetail perfectly. So if you felt it was too much math for one talk, it'll get spread over two talks. And I thought it was wonderful. Wonderful talk. Yeah. Absolutely. You can have a portion of my debt. So our subject really here, so it's possibility and measure, quantum measurement, that, you know, it's actually several topics and maybe an infinite number of topics. I really like to narrow it down to possibility and Schwinger's theory of measurement. And again, I think the last talk really touched upon a number of things which really provide a wonderful context for what I wanted to talk about and was afraid I wouldn't be able to do very well. I still might not, but hopefully you can at least learn the concerns that I have about measurement and my respect for what Schwinger did by focusing on something different, which was, again, the difference between what's quantum, what's classical, and what she said was actually measurement. Which I agree about very much. And in fact, one of the things that led me to this concern was trying to understand exactly where there might be some boundary between microscopic and macroscopic. And if you actually look at the history of physics in the last 100 years, you realize there's really only one way of doing that, and that's more or less the statistical way, which is entirely classical. So something funny happened between von Neumann's discussion of macroscopic things and people's use of the term macroscopic to do something special in their interpretations of quantum mechanics. So we try to avoid that and really think about measurement as a process where quantumness is exhibited in a way that distinguishes the quantum from the classical, and that's really where Schwinger started. So he treated measurement as a discrete process, and from this basic treatment, which was essentially algebraic treatment, which is more or less follow 50% of, I'll give references at the end, but the first half of the talk, if you go and look at the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences paper that I referenced at the end of Schwinger, you see a lot of what was discussed, all of the algebra basically derived from an intuition which he considered an induction of measurement theory, from which he then went on in ways that I can't possibly address here to reach the full quantum formalism and actually touch upon field theory. So Schwinger's own perspective is, of course, different from mine and most everyone's, in part because actually he considered himself a kind of Copenhagenist, and as we know, there's no such thing as a unified Copenhagen interpretation. So he's another person who was influenced by Bohr and Heisenberg, and this drove his thinking a lot, as you'll see when I try to motivate things here. And also, as pointed out in the last talk, the beauty of Dirac's book struck Schwinger, and I think he entered university or maybe even graduate school at 15 or 16 years old, very young. And he read Dirac's book, and it just took over his mind. I mean, it never left his mind. And the whole idea of looking at mathematics as the basis for understanding the world was very strong in him. So he basically decided to draw the line between quantum and classical physics at measurement. He said, well, what happens in measurement? Something happens, and it's a discrete process, and the interior bits we can't really answer right now. What is happening in the measurement process? He doesn't presume very much about it. Okay, I would say that his opinion about it was that measurement is not necessarily dynamically irreducible, but he didn't have a reduction to point to. So he decided to treat quantum mechanics what he called phenomenologically, and that terminology is probably not the one that comes to mind when most physicists think about phenomenology these days, so I don't want to lean on it too heavily. But just to point out that what he's doing is a little bit different from what you'd standardly read. There's a book ostensibly authored by Schwinger, which is actually the notes that he hoped eventually to make into a book and never was satisfied to do, that came out recently with Berge Englert as the editor. It's basically a collection of papers. And you can also read Sam Schwager's book, QED. a lot of the interpretational side of what Schwinger had in mind, in case you're interested, which I strongly suggest reading. It's also the same as the introduction, more or less, that you'll find in this book edited by Englert. So the main thing which makes the perspective of Schwinger a Copenhagen-type one, and again, I mean that in the sense that somehow floats in our heads because of all the things we read, is the idea of Heisenberg that there's no measurement without disturbance. Okay? And this disturbance is something which is uncontrollable, so quantum measurement is an uncontrollable process. And the important thing for addressing modality in some sense here is the idea that you have possible outcomes in an individual measurement of something which belongs to an ensemble, which is defined by something like a preparation, which is basically what Schwinger will say, the sort of system that a particular measurement device that he idealizes in a way that I'll explain in a little while would accept and then possibly transform. And this isn't really something he would say, but constrained by Born's rule, the probabilities that come out, the way the probabilities are calculated is essentially Born's rule. I think that Schwinger would say that he probably derived this in a way. I'm not really clear on the point, so I don't want to go that far. But certainly the value precisions, the joint value attributions you could give to a system are limited by the uncertainty relations. So you're not going to have the joint probability distributions that you'd ideally like to have. And that's, again, something that distinguishes quantum measurement from classical measurement. So I want to make it clear, I'm not really talking about modal interpretation just because of the nature of the way that this colloquium came together. Just to point out, in case it hasn't been or too well, I missed the first talk or so, that in modal approaches there are basically two sorts of state you want to talk about, the dynamical state, which is more or less the one we talk about in the textbooks of quantum mechanics, and the value state, which represents the actual system properties. In Schwinger's treatment, there's no such thing as a value state. And of course, there would be a modal relationship between the two, so the dynamical state would tell you something about the possibility of the value state actually having particular properties in each case. Schwinger is being, again, Copenhagenist, in other words, traditional orthodox. Again, I don't like any of these terms. He just used the plain old wave function, okay, and never talked about something like a value state. So it's not really a modal interpretation. But it still does provide probabilities that correspond to possibilities of seeing properties in outcomes if you believe in the eigenvalue eigenstate link, which I believe Schwinger probably did. And so this final statement about Schwinger's way of looking at things, he, like Einstein, I would say, at least in public talk, believed that quantum mechanics only spoke about ensembles and that's it, nothing more. But that doesn't mean we can't think about that, and I'm actually very interested in that because actually there are individual measurement outcomes. They're real things, right? They're facts. So my interest here is trying to understand the nature of the possibility in quantum mechanics and try to find some kind of principled basis on which you could make this move from, this is my description, it's the best one we have, it's quantum mechanics, and then click, I get a particular outcome. So that's my concern. It's really a concern, and I'm trying to address it in a way which touches upon the idea of possible worlds and possibility in a way that you'll see when I get to my ostensible explanation of things or attempt at getting to a basis. So Schwinger thought about talking about quantum mechanics phenomenologically. Why? There are basically two elements that one cannot escape in a quantum measurement. It's that state disturbance by measurement is not arbitrarily small when you go to the microscopic level. And this is due to the nature of forces, and this is an interesting thing because you start to ask yourself very interesting questions. Like, if you read Salam, for example, talking about fundamental forces, he really seems to believe that virtual particles actually exist. Now, if you actually think about them from a philosophical point of view, you have a lot of trouble establishing their existence in any kind of clean way. Nonetheless, you can feel that in the intuition of a physicist, is there something discrete going on, there's something like a virtual particle happening there. That is all you can say coherently about that, is it's the nature of forces. So something with the nature of forces makes the interaction uncontrollable, or at least not arbitrarily small. You can't take the limit that my disturbance on the system that I measure will be as small as I want, like you can in classical measurement. And that's the main distinction to get you to the quantum level. Moreover, and this is perhaps the most important point, you can't correct for the disturbance. Of course, when you measure something classically, in any realistic case, you're going to disturb the thing, So it's going to be affected, but again, the theory allows you to correct for that. Okay, in that sense, you can control what's going on. In quantum mechanics, you can't. Okay, this is Schwinger's point of view, and I don't have a good reason for disagreeing with it, actually. Moreover, if you try to think about what happens when you go from the description of one ensemble to a post-selected ensemble, you definitely have something non-unitary going on. Now, of course, one reason for that is that you've thrown out part of your ensemble, so of course it's not a unitary transformation. Your probabilities that things are going to change and so on. Okay, but nonetheless, this is true. In measurement, you have non-unitary, should be state evolution, I don't know why, value evolution. And if you think about the state as a value, it's still true. Okay, so you have definite outcomes occurring consistently with statistical interpretation, and as far as we can see, these are irreducibly random. And this is what I really what concerns me, why I'm thinking about these issues. What about this randomness? As I mentioned, if you read the treatment of measurement by Schwinger, it's very mathematical, it's very beautiful, it's like the first half of the talk that we saw. There's an intuition behind every step. It's very plain on paper. And if you read Schwaber's book or other discussions about what happened when people were in the Harvard lectures of Schwinger, everyone came away, that was the most brilliant lecture I've ever seen. They go to dinner, they try to talk about it, they have no idea what happened. And I'm not kidding. I mean, across the board, you know, all of the great famous people who were in those classes, they say the same thing. It was just, you know, you felt like there was some kind of communing going on, and then afterward there's just no understanding of what really happened. Maybe that happens to more people than they're willing to acknowledge, but these guys, they acknowledged it. And so this is something we have to fight, right? I mean, you'd like to see beauty but not be overwhelmed so you're not even rational about it. So my getting beyond this beauty is the question about this irreducible randomness. Because what happens at some point in this derivation, quite far along, and again, most of it was shown about in terms of the algebra of the random variables that was just discussed, okay? You go along with all of this, and then why are these things random? How could they be random? Is there any principled basis for this randomness? And this is my primary concern, personally, which I hope you find also somewhat interesting. So, again, I didn't really know that I was going to have such a nice setup. What I want to do is talk about a little bit different, point out the distinction of Schwinger's approach from the random variable approach that we saw. And the algebra is essentially the same. All the moves are the same. But what one's discussing here are measurement symbols. So the basic things of the symbols, the mathematical characters that appeared on the paper that Schwinger was talking about, he labeled them M, and the idea was that these M's are supposed to represent what happens in something like a generalization of the finite, or at least initially finite, discrete process of having some apparatus in which something comes in, the apparatus accepts certain kinds of input ensembles and produces certain kind of other output ensembles. And that process is like a black box, and you label it M, and there are different kinds of M depending on what happens. If it's selective, non-selective, just nothing happens at all. Okay? But if there's any kind of measurement, there's disturbance of any superposition of the symbols. And because he's starting with measurement as the basis of quantum mechanics, there's no discussion of states. States are not there. It's measurement processes, which is very beautiful and very smart. And he shows you exactly, if you want states, I'll show you where you're going to get your states from. You can have them. They're a little bit like conditionalized things, if you want to think about it the right way. Okay. And the way that he set up the connection with physics for students was, well, okay, so you know what happens to Jangelic apparatuses, and there's some slits with a magnet, you screen, you get two different spots that show up, and if you didn't have the state exactly prepared, well, so if you didn't have it prepared in one of the eigenstates, you'll end up with two spots rather than one. Any superposition that one would have in such a case will be lost. And if you really want to have a definite outcome of this process, which is a quantum output, then you can really think about having a post-selected ensemble. I take only the beam that goes up, I block the beam that goes down, and then I've got this beam comes in, it was a superposition, in a superposition state if you want to talk about states, and it comes out in this upper beam, and that's another state. So you're post-selecting. So the way people usually deal with these things is the whole idea of actualization. And again, to mention Abner, whose thinking was always inspirational for me, you know, whenever he talked about this, well, there's this objective indefiniteness in the world, there are potentialities, a la Heisenberg, and then there's an actualization. Okay, and that kind of idea is still fine if you understand mathematically what you're doing, and then you say, well, if I'm having to talk about a particular individual system, there is something that happens, so if you like, you can call that an actualization of potentiality. I prefer to back away from that sort of heavy vocabulary and simply say that there was a possibility and it's realized. Okay, so I have a little bit of quote here, just to see a little bit of the talk of Stringer. So he talks about the selective operation, and that's what I just mentioned. Selective operation, symbolized by this M, A prime, involves the functioning of an apparatus capable of separating an ensemble into sub-ensembles that are distinguished by the various values of A prime, okay, just like in the Stringer-like apparatus, and then selecting out one, rejecting the others. Of course, if you just block a beam, that's what you get. Okay. So, consequences for theoretical description of starting with these symbols is that you get a natural non-commutative measurement algebra, just like we saw of the random variables, if you like, in the first half of the previous talk. This is the Stringer algebra, and from that you can go along, and if you read Faraj Rajan and the quote I will show you at the citation I'll show you at the end, the reference, you will see that you can get the Q number state vectors and probabilistic predictions. That business is already actually in Stringer, and then you can get the full formalism of quantum mechanics if you just add a little bit of work. Accardi and some other people, Varadarajan, have shown how to do that. So basically, you can get quantum mechanics from these symbols. That's the takeaway. Okay? So when you can do that, as Stringer assumed you could do and others cleaned up little bits because he never really tied the bow on it in the end, Stringer identified measurement symbols with operators over the Hilbert space, and you can construct in the usual way any operator you want from these projective-like things, although they can be more general. You can have not necessarily A prime, but A prime, A double prime, or so, tetras. Okay, so where does the business of the randomness come in? So, again, because we've seen a lot of the mathematics, let me just focus on this key point here. So, in constructing these symbols, you have these MA primes with the selective measurements. Then you have the generic sort of measurement thing, which takes in, if you'd like to talk about state, takes in a certain state and gives out another state. And the moves start to become interesting when you try to connect the symbols for a non-selective measurement with a selective measurement. And basically, you have these phase relations between them. So this is a kind of superposition of the measurement operators in the non-selective measurement. Okay, and then what Stringer says is where the real phases here, phi, are independently randomly distributed quantities. He just says it like that. Okay, this is just a mathematical move, and he just says that that's what happens in a non-selective measurement. So the effect of making a measurement without selecting is to disturb the system, just like Heisenberg said, and what you will get out from that disturbance is these independently randomly distributed quantities. And it's the uncontrollable nature of the disturbance that finds its expression in these random phase factors. Okay, so that's the disturbance. You get these randomly occurring phase factors. Okay, again, a nice way of expressing the idea of there being something random. Random occurrence of things which are possible. The selective measurements are discussed in this way. It should be noted also that within this probability context of getting an outcome, the symbols of the elementary selective measurements are derived from the non-selective symbol by replacing all but one of the phases by positive infinite imaginary numbers, which is an absorptive description of the process of rejecting sub-ensembles. So again, he's focusing on the phases and saying, well, something happens with the phases such that we have only one that's a real physical one. The other ones are non-physical, so that's our selection out, if you like the projection. Okay, but he's really talking about a fundamental randomness doing this, not I take this projector and there's some kind of, I don't know, Ur process. Okay? Again, I think Stringer believed that successive theories would be able to handle this better, and that the ontology of systems is really not the one you want anyway. You want to be talking about fields or something beyond, because as many people know, he was not very happy with quantum field theory and went to source theory. Okay. So I'm interested in the ground for this randomness, the choice of randomness. First of all, the idea that you have these randomly occurring phases, and then he randomly takes one of them to be finite and the other to be others to be not finite. Okay? So The only way that I could imagine to address this in some kind of principled manner was to think about what's happening on Leibnizian level or post-Leibnizian level. And I thought this is really interesting. We have all of these possibilities realized in an ensemble, an ideal ensemble. We have all of them realized. So can there be some sort of principle that we can look to on which to ground these mathematical moves? Because the intuitions and physical intuitions behind all the other moves, and the algebra is very clear, and the arguments for why you should have involution, algebra, and all these things, you see them. But the randomness is just sort of blankly stated. Okay, so the plenitude principle is something which Leibniz and other people, it goes as far as back as Aristotle. And by the way, I think that the potentialities, or Aristotelian potentialities, can really be actually quite well connected with Aristotle, but it takes really hard work because he believed that rocks were animated and things. So his idea of changed state was quite radical. So whenever you have a condition that the laws that you're looking at have impotence, that they're impotent, they can't control everything, then you have these possibilities that law doesn't address. Quantum mechanics, you have that because your fundamental description is statistical, and you have a kind of constraint on your ability to see what are the attribute values to properties simultaneously. And I jumped over the non-commutative bit, which is an important part because it was so well addressed in the previous talk. So you have a law which is limited. So when you think about the plenitude principle, what you say is, well, if the law is limited, then I can move a little bit. I can get somewhere conceptually by thinking about some principles that might give me the outcomes I need, at least in some sensible way. That's a little bit more than just saying we have independently distributed random variables, random outcomes. So there are two precedents in the 20th century for using something like the plenitude principle, and even the plenitude principle isn't so clear, and actually if you read Professor Hintikka on, it's very interesting. He really talks about how it's really bad terminology. So I'm going to try to just give you instances to see where it goes.
You use states in the previous slide, now you talk processes.
So let me see.
States
of affairs. States of affairs. So states of affairs are...
Really a process.
So when I say states of affairs, I'm really saying possible worlds would be a reasonable way to...
You don't mean state in the sense...
No, I mean states of affairs. Maybe I should have put hyphens in there. I'm sorry. It's always hard to dovetail certain things.
You could put process just as well, instead of state of affairs.
Sure. Yes. Because you have a condition on the preparation. And that's right. Yeah, that's right. You know, I'm still working on this. Thanks for the input, Yael. It'll help me, actually. Okay, so in our context, I propose the following. A state of affairs not precluded by law or by another actualized possible current state of affairs will occur. In other words, if law is saying... Oh, I jumped. No, but because you asked me this, I jumped. I didn't get to read Dirac. I'm sorry. I've already gone to my formalization. So the two precedents for using something like a plenitude principle in 20th century physics, one is Dirac talking about electron-positron annihilation, and he was really talking about electrons and holes, and that you could have annihilation processes, and it was really tough business trying to understand what the mathematics was telling him. But he said, well, there's no reason electron, positron annihilation can't happen. It's perfectly consistent, so I'm not going to say that it's not what's happening when I do certain calculations. And Gell-Mann is much stronger, the so-called totalitarian principle. Everything not forbidden is compulsory. So if the law doesn't say that you can have a particular outcome, you will have that outcome. Okay? Now, we're in the situation, and now I get into my next state, where we have a range of possible values. Now, okay, so what Gell-Mann was talking about is you could have certain processes happening between certain pairs of particles in particle physics, which is actually processes, so that's good. But a state of affairs not precluded by law or another actualized possible current of state of affairs will occur is the formulation that I think will be valuable for understanding or grounding this move of Schwinger towards reaching quantum mechanics from measurement. Okay? If no law prevents a set of possible but mutually exclusive states of affairs, then one and only one of the members of the allowed set will certainly occur. Which one? There's no reason to take one over the other. So this is uniformly random occurrence unless otherwise constrained. Okay, so your ability to say that you reach these range of possibilities is grounded in the plenitude principle. which Leibniz used to argue for the existence of the continuum in real numbers in the realm of mathematics. He wasn't really thinking about physics. So how does this connect with physics? Because most people here understand the physics more than the algebra and more than Schwinger's measurement algebra. So let me make a little connection between the usual way of talking about things, which is really to talk about states and what happens to states during measurements, like projection of the state, and what Schwinger was doing. So if you think about the measurement problem, which is really what's, in a way, going on here, because you've got this black box and something happens, okay, how do you deal with it? I'm saying this black box does random things, that's what Schwinger said, and I'm saying that you can understand it via plenitude. And there are two elements to the standard measurement problem, that of, sometimes it's called reduction, I would call it disturbance here, and selection. And actually, those are the two things that, in fact, Schwinger talks about in his description of what happens with the measurement operators, which are symbols for processes. Okay, but you can think about this in the state language, and I could show you how to do that if I went back. But more or less, the measurement symbols are something like projectors and Kedbras. So, these two stages, you can apply the principle of plenitude to the phase values in each of these two stages to understand from the standard way of discussing quantum mechanics via states what happens. Okay, so the phases associated with subatomic systems while under measurement, and this is for, it's the black box, so while doesn't really mean anything. There's no time here except there's an order. I measure P and then I measure Q, or I measure Q and then I measure P. Later on, you can get time. You have to use the action principle and other things. The phases associated with subatomic system while under measurement are subject to the Heisenberg disturbance. That means they become indeterminate. All values are possible. This is the reduction. All phase values associated with each possible outcome will arise in the measurement ensemble with equal likelihood, because there's no reason for them for one to occur rather than the other, so there's a perfect symmetry there. Values will occur randomly in the corresponding ensemble that you have prepared, and that is what's reflected in the non-selective measurement symbol of Schwinger. Okay, so you get these random phases. You basically get the dephasing. Decoherence, but not through any other kind of mechanism. Okay, this is decoherence a la Leibniz. Okay, selection, the outcome. What outcome do you get? Okay, the outcomes A prime associated with non-zero state amplitudes of individual subatomic systems, which are not really addressed by the theory, are all possible during measurement, which theory treats as a black box, but then an elemental black box on which the theory is constructed. Individuals will occur, individual outcomes occur, and they do randomly occur within the statistical constraints provided by the Born rules applied to the full ensemble. And again, I think Schwinger would say, actually, I derived the Born rule, if you look very carefully, how I combine these measurement symbols and I think about preparing A, making a measurement and getting A coming out and taking A in and outputting B, you will see something like the Born rule anyway, so that may actually be internal to theory anyway. But the point is that only one of these phases is an actual physical value, or say corresponding to an actual physical value. The others take infinite values. And again, because there's no particular reason to choose one rather than the other, and all are possible, one has this independently distributed random variable. And that is the way that I believe that one can add a little bit of depth to where there was none in Schwinger's beautiful mathematical derivation of quantum mechanics from measurement, which, again, focuses not on states but rather on processes and their non-commutativity. And I think that adds something to his beautiful derivation, which has been highly neglected, I have to say. And in the talks I've given in the last year on Schwinger and on this treatment, uniformly people say, oh my God, I didn't even know that existed. Great man of Harvard University, Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, series of papers, beautiful mathematics, you know, dazzled people, and it's almost been forgotten, and it's crazy because I believe that it's as powerful if you read the full series of papers as Feynman's approach. So that's all I have to say today. If you're interested in more details, here are some references for you.